Radio.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the change of the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the live special edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, tackling all of the most controversial topics with many of the most interesting guests since 2006. Tonight, we're going where few mainstream broadcasts dare to go. We're questioning some sacred cows. We're talking about things you're not allowed to talk about on the radio or on social media. And the sacred cows that we're talking about in an uncensored way tonight include the transsexual agenda and Jewish power. In the second hour, Adam Green comes on to talk about his new video, Rabbis Explain the Abrahamic Judeo Takeover Conspiracy. Now, I don't really agree with Adam's analysis, but I think he's actually pointing at a topic that needs to be discussed. And I'm not going to just sit back and call him names. I'm actually going to talk about it with him and use critical thinking to figure out where he's right, where he's wrong. I think that's how we should do it with all of these controversial topics. First hour, more controversy, LGBTQ, the trans agenda in the schools, medical interventions to turn boys into girls and vice versa. Where did all this come from? Maybe I'm getting old, but this brave new world we're in strikes me as very strange. And you're not allowed to question it or you will be silenced. Well, not here on Truth Jihad Radio. Bringing on a very brave doctor who has been outside the box and very successful, from what I understand, in dealing with COVID issues and telling the truth about them. And now he's also calling it the way he sees it about the trans issue. So Dr. Syed Haidar is really a hero for a whole lot of folks. He runs the mygotodoc.com website, and he's willing to go where only the brave dare strike out to explore that forbidden territory. So let's talk about it. Hey, welcome, Dr. Syed Haidar. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be with you. I mean, I think I was first introduced to you and some of your writing on uns.com. I don't know if you know that website. I think you post there sometimes. So, yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do have a regular rubric at uns.com, UNZ.com, which is another place, like Truth Jihad Radio, where we can talk about anything we want and not get shut down. and of course, one of these topics that people are so sensitive about these days is this whole sort of trans thing that's becoming a fad. And that scares me because, you know, people are imitative creatures. And when they latch on to a fad, like, remember Beatlemania? I was just a little young for Beatlemania back in the 60s. But transmania, like kids lining up to get puberty blockers and surgery, this doesn't strike me as healthy. And I guess you feel the same way.
Absolutely. You know, the reason that I decided to start talking about it, you know, my publicist came to me, you know, during, you know, this what they call Pride Month, which I might, you know, rename Shame Month. But she came to me and she said, you know, why don't you talk about this? And I was like, it's not really on brand. I don't know if it's really something that, you know, people want to hear from me. But then during one of my interviews, I was talking, I mentioned that I thought that the greatest threat against our children was the shot, you know, the clot shot that they're rolling out to babies. Because, you know, it's a terrible shot. The studies are garbage and a lot of people are dying and being, you know, disabled by it. And there's really no emergency at all in children to even, you know, to argue that you even need anything, right? To give them anything. And then after that interview, I started thinking about it and I realized, you know what, the trans agenda is far worse for the world's, for at least our children, right? It's not everywhere in the world, but at least in the US, this is far more dangerous. This ideology is being rolled out in the schools. And you know, it is from, in one sense, I guess you could say a fad, but it's an engineered fad, right? I mean, it didn't just grow organically. There's a lot of big money behind it. You know, the Pritzker family of billionaires, they're pushing it quite hard. One of their members, I think, is trans. And so, you know, they, like all, you know, billionaire philanthropy, it's kind of like, you know, circular. You know, the money they spend comes back and feeds their coffers, you know, through the business interests that they have. So they give a lot of donations to medical schools. So I think they're out of Chicago anyway. They donate to medical schools. They donate to all kinds of things, you know, and this trans ideology, a lot of it is being, you know, manufactured by their philanthropic foundations. And then it feeds back into their businesses. So they sell, you know, they have medical businesses, surgical supply businesses. And of course they're trying to, you know, engineer a society in their image, or at least the image of one of their members. But it goes back a lot longer than that. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the Frankfurt School and critical theory and, you know, John Money. And, you know, these ideas are really old and they're basically a way, it seems to be, to destroy Western civilization, or at least, you know, these kind of liberal democracies that we live in from the inside out. And it's been a long time coming. You know, it was kind of, you know, when I was a kid, or at least when I was a teenager, I remember seeing a movie, right, with a trans character in it. And that was like the first time I even knew that such a thing existed. And what I would argue is that children should be sheltered from even the idea, right, of evil things. They shouldn't even be told these things exist. Like, would anyone go and describe in great detail how we torture prisoners in Guantanamo Bay to their kids? Or describe, like, you know, sex work or something to your kids, or like, you know, you just don't want to expose them to some things, right? Would you talk about, like, societies that were cannibalistic or something, right? Like, it's like there's a certain age for these things, right? And until somebody reaches that age, you want to, you know, shelter them. And that's what societies have historically done. So this is really concerning because children, they have a magical way of thinking about the world, and you really got to think it. You have to kind of have magical thinking to accept the whole trans ideology anyway. But children are particularly at risk of really believing it, right? As kids, you know, they believe in Santa Claus, the tooth fairy. So if somebody comes to them and says, like, little Johnny is turned into little Debbie or something, like, they believe it's literal, right? They really think that's, you know, actually happened, and they're worried it might happen to them sometimes. Right. So planting those seeds in elementary school or in middle school, but like very early, that's what's happening now in schools around America. And I've moved to Puerto Rico. It's even happening here. I mean, we know parents who are taking their kids out of schools, and that's what I would suggest you have to do at this point. You got to homeschool. You got to join like a group of people maybe to help you homeschool, but schools are not a safe place for growing minds at this point in America, at least. And social media is not safe. You got to protect your kids from social media. The internet is not safe, right? It's like having, you know, a one-click access to the red light district in your pocket, right? Like you used to have to like travel to the other side of your city or maybe another city entirely to be exposed to even the ideas, let alone like the images and the people that were doing these things. Now it's one click away from your child at all times. If one of their friends has a phone in their pocket, it's like one click away on their friend's phone. So you got to be careful about who your kids associate with, the other families that you associate with, and you got to find like-minded people, you know, because you are responsible for your children. And the latest, you know, research is showing that 9 to 40%, somewhere between 9 and 40% of Gen Z identifies as LGBTQ. And so this is the end of civilizations. It's an evolutionary dead end. You know, the civilizations that go down this path to the extent that we're going down it, they're done with, you know, they're over and done with. They don't survive. A different civilization takes their place, and continues, you know, the human race, hopefully, if it doesn't spread to everyone. And so this is really, it's an epic battle between good and evil. And the way I define, you know, one way to define evil is anything that hastens on the end of the world or the end of humanity, at least the world for us. So it brings on, it makes that come faster, and in dropping birth rates, you know, they bring on the end of humanity a little bit faster, and we're going to have terrible economic devastation, very soon with the collapsing birth rates. We're not going to have enough people to, you know, the real estate markets will crash because there's not going to be anyone to live in the houses or buy the houses. Everything is going to crash. The economy will crash. We're not going to be able to take care of the elderly, and we're not going to be able to grow enough food. I mean, we're just not going to have anything, right? And this is what a lot of, you know, really intelligent people are truly worried about. Instead of, you know, exploding, you know, populations, it's the end of populations. It's the collapsing populations that we should really be worried about. So, you know, it's not climate change that we should really be worried about. It's this, right? It's these ideologies that, you know, are the death knell of societies.
And you mentioned that this has been engineered, and you mentioned the Pritzker family out of Chicago. They're one of the big money families behind Obama. Right. Obama went straight from the Russian studies at Columbia University with Brzezinski to Harvard, where he was anointed as the law review editor. His first job out of college was CIA. He was a CIA guy in Pakistan, apparently. And then they sent him to Chicago to be a quote unquote community organizer rather than the impoverished communities he was supposed to be helping. He was actually working with people like the Pritzkers and other billionaires who ended up setting him up. And so, you know, we're living in a society that has been largely engineered by oligarchs and their hired technicians. And Brzezinski wrote about this in his 60s work, The Technotronic Society. And I wonder if you think that along with the engineering in a sense to be more like them, and especially the Pritzker who's already sex changed or whatever, but they're also engineering people this way perhaps as a response to their perceived environmental crisis, because there are obviously a certain segment of this elite believes that population has gone beyond sustainability and has to be reduced by fair means or foul. And I wonder if this sort of engineering of gender, you know, into something that's no longer very reproductive, along with the COVID bioweapon and the COVID shots, both of which appear to be impairing fertility to some extent. I wonder if you think there could be a kind of Malthusian agenda behind this.
I think it could be that, right? Although it seems to me that, like, these people, you know, the real elites, right, the multi-billionaires, I mean, how can they not know that this, like, climate change thing is just BS? I mean, like, you don't have to be that smart, right? Like, you just need to do a little bit of research to realize that it's not what it's cracked up to be. But sure, yeah, I mean, you know, some of these people may really have bought that, you know.
Okay, let me quickly interrupt you and ask for the best, what do you think are the best sources that are making your, you know, your argument on climate change?
So I went down this rabbit hole a long time ago, but I think one of the most convincing kind of more mainstream guys talking about this is Alex Epstein. And he's talking about what, you know, why fossil fuel use is the ethical thing for humanity to do. And one of and so he has kind of a different take on it. So he says, you know, fine, I accept climate change is real. And maybe it's like to some extent, you know, caused by humanity. Right. So that I think is up for debate. And if there should be a very vigorous debate on whether we actually have any effect on the climate or not. But even if you buy the fact that we do, his argument is that the technology, like using more energy, allows us to master the climate. It doesn't matter what the climate is. More people will survive. More people will live, a happy, healthy, productive life if we use the maximum amount of energy possible, right? So for like one just simple example, in African countries, they don't have the power to run like an ICU or like a generator to power the electricity in their hospital. And so babies die instead of being put in incubators, right? So something that, you know, somebody could easily, you know, survive in a third, you know, first world country is a death sentence in a third world country because they don't have power. And so that's just a simple example. But the main point, I think the kind of the main thing is that it's unethical not to allow everyone in the world access to cheap, you know, easy energy, which is fossil fuels. And certainly, you know, you can't replace them at this point in time. I mean, it may be pie in the sky. I mean, I don't know if you'll ever be able to truly replace them, but they're irreplaceable right now because, you know, everything else, we don't have the battery technology to, you know, keep the power on. So, you know, so there's all these arguments, like in Germany, for example, you know, oh, supposedly, you know, solar power is like cheaper than other power, right? It's BS because every time you build a solar facility, you have to like back it up like 100% with oil, coal or oil or gas or something, right?
They're learning that the hard way this winter when the Russian gas supply is shut off.
Yeah, so people are going to starve. You know, they're going to die from the cold in the summer from the heat. And so another one of his arguments is like if you look back, like climate-related deaths have plummeted in the last 100 years, like dramatically, like they're down like 99%. And so this argument that like people are going to die because of climate change holds no water. Okay. People are going to die if they don't have access to, you know, heating in the winter and, you know, cooling in the summer. That's what kills people, right? It's not the climate itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, the climate change advocates are claiming that there are these, well, issues like the Himalayan snow packs. If we lose those, then I forget exactly how many billions of people lose their water supply. And then the oceans are being acidified, which could really wipe out the food chains in the oceans and radically cut down on the life in the oceans, which, of course, would be terrible for the people that depend on seafood. There are a number of these kinds of issues that they point at. I've looked into this argument, including some fairly strong stuff on the climate change skepticism side. I think it's inconclusive, really, you know, how extremely serious and how fast this is coming. And I think you're probably right about the necessity of fossil fuels at this point. I don't know. Have you looked at the Thrive movies and these other folks who are pointing at the likelihood that there actually are advanced energy sources, cold fusion and other quote unquote free energy sources that have been suppressed? And for instance, you know, one hypothesis would be, it was expressed by my friend Gordon Duff, the former CIA guy who claims that when he had an MJ-12 security clearance, he was told that indeed there are these free energy sources available. The ETs use them, but we can't break them out on Earth right now because if we did, Earth's population would get so big that all kinds of other environmental problems would break out. So even saving the world from global warming would not just be a drop in the bucket compared to what happens when you get 50 billion people on Earth, which is what would, and most of that would be in Africa. You get 40 billion people or something like that in Africa within, I forget how many decades. This is what the CIA memo supposedly said, according to Gordon. So they consciously are suppressing these things. And there are all kinds of anecdotal stories about people who have been tinkering with these technologies and then had the men in black show up and basically make sure they didn't tinker anymore. So have you looked into that stuff?
I haven't, but, you know, you don't even have to posit, you know, free energy or like cold fusion. I mean, we have nuclear power, right? Like, it's been held back for 50 years, right? You know, we could be green tomorrow if we wanted to. We just have to build nuclear power plants everywhere, right? I mean, the technology is actually far safer than people make it out to be. I mean, it's extremely safe nowadays. And it's one of the safest technologies in terms of, like, you know, pollutants and everything overall, right? If you look at the record for nuclear power versus oil and gas, and you're talking about the environment, it's far cleaner. And it's plentiful, right? There's way more, you know, that we can have as much power as we want tomorrow, right? Or in 10 or 20 years.
So we don't need, right, to, like, turn the whole world into, we don't need to turn everybody into hermaphrodites then.
No. So yeah, there's plentiful energy. You can grow enough, you know, as much food as you really want, right? I mean, there's ways to maximize food output. That's not the problem. So I think, you know, so getting back to, like, do they really believe this or not, you know, at the highest levels? Maybe it's more like they're afraid of the pitchforks coming out and, you know, eventually everyone just getting fed up and, you know, coming after them and killing them, putting their heads on a stick and, you know, marching through the streets. That may be more of the concern, because if everyone just, like, you know, gets fed up all at once, it doesn't matter how many tanks and guns you have, right? Like, you just can't put down, an entire population that rises up, you know, to kill the 1%, right? To overthrow the tyrannical regime. Maybe they'll stop worrying once they have, like, you know, killer robots or something, you know, patrolling the skies, and, you know, armies of these robots.
Yeah, we better rise up before that happens.
Yes, we better. I mean, this is what I tell people. They're basically, all of this stuff, even the transgender stuff, right? It's about multiplying division, right? It's not about acceptance. It's about creating, like, millions of different little tiny sub-tribes, right? Like, now we're going to have the cat tribe, right? All the kids who believe they're cats, and the wolf tribe, right? Like,
I don't even want to see the surgeries they're going to do on those kids.
Yeah. So yes, what is the, I mean, the division is there so that people don't realize that they have 99.99% of things in common. You know, they have common interests, right? Like, everyone, you know, inflation doesn't benefit 99.9% of people, right? It benefits the rich, you know, who get, you know, whose wealth is in assets that go up in price. It benefits the real estate owners. It benefits the, you know, the stockholders. So most people can't put together enough, you know, two pennies to rub together to buy a stock. You know, they just don't have, you know, savings. They have a few $100 maybe at a time. So division is the entire purpose, I think, for a lot of things that go on. And a lot of it is, you know, there's controlled opposition. There's, you know, the CIA, you know, riling people up. And there's people, and I think it's, like, done online to a tremendous extent, right? I think there's people in our government, their entire job is just to go online and just, like, leave comments on websites. And
so how much do they pay these people to be trolls, do you think? Probably more than I'm making being a conspiracy theorist, being, you know, being trolled all the time.
Yeah. I mean, some of these people are really good at it, right? They just pop in and, you know, say the right thing and then disappear, or, you know, they keep popping in and keep saying the right thing. And this division prevents people from joining together, joining forces. So really, if we all just decided to drop our little tiny minute differences, and that, you know, the biggest perceived differences are amongst groups that are the most similar. Okay. Like, you know, Jews and Muslims, or like Christians and Muslims, right? Like, these groups are far more similar than they are different, right? In terms of their morality systems. And I'm not talking about, like, maybe certain subsects might be quite dangerous. And, you know, I know some people are very anti-Jewish and they think that they're, you know, in control of everything in the world, but it's not most Jews, right? It's not the
majority. Yeah, that's one of the points I'll be making to Adam Green in the second hour tonight.
I don't want to really get down into that rabbit hole, but my point is that, like, the majority of humanity, it's kind of on the same page in terms of what they want, right, from their government or from their life. You know, they want a roof over their heads, and they want, you know, food that they can afford, and they want, you know, that most people would love if they could survive on a single income, right? Like, you know, and not have to, you know, have two parents work. And so, like, you know, the requirements are, you know, just they want, you know, to be able to pay for gas to put in their car, to be able to go on vacation once in a while. You know, I mean, certainly first world wants are a little bit, you know, different than third world ones, but really what's really important to most people is the same thing, right? And then there's these tiny little ideological differences that account for, you know, 99.99% of the discord on our planet. And they're just, you know, they're used by the elite to keep us down, right? Because we can't get enough people, you know, to join one group to threaten them, to threaten their power.
Well, what would you say to people who would say, well, you're actually right about all of this, Dr. Heider, but don't you think that pushing back against the trans thing is actually kind of feeding the divisiveness, that they're almost kind of baiting us, you know, trolling us with this trans thing, and then we respond, and then they respond, and it becomes such a thing that, you know, we're actually just by going there and talking about it, we're contributing to the divisiveness. How do we respond to that?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's an interesting question. It's a great question. So my perception of this issue is that it's evil, and they are slowly transforming they're slowly eroding the silent majority in this country across generations, right? And so if everyone had just spoken out 50 years ago, we wouldn't be here where we are today. But like I said before, 9 to 40% of Gen Z is LGBT identified.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's up with that? Is that the plastics,
crazy,
the
right?
environment?
You know, yeah. I mean, so some people might say there's chemicals, but it's because it's in the schools. It's because it's invaded the schools, and kids are being exposed to the idea very early, right? And then it's like the cool thing, right? It's like, You want to ask your kids, your friends, like, you know, what do you identify as? And no one wants to say I'm just like plain vanilla, right? Like, just a normal person. And so
that's cool. That's like the San Francisco ethos. I lived in San Francisco for a while, from like 81 to 94 or something like that. And vanilla is a kind of a term of abuse in those cultures.
Right. And so, you want to be the new sexy thing, right? The new cool thing, the thing that all the cool kids are, right? And so, and you can become popular overnight, you know, especially online, extremely fast, and grow your follower count or whatever. That's what, you know, Gen Z cares about. But to get back to your question, I think that, you know, when evil rears its ugly head, if everyone just remains silent, it wins out in the end, right? So even if it's a losing battle, you know, in the long run, even if, you know, we're on life support in America, you know, as a society, as a culture, the right thing to do from a larger perspective, from the point of view of like eternity, right, for people who believe in the next world and the next life, what would, you know, for Christians, what would Jesus do? For, you know, other, you know, monotheists, what would God want you to do? And so that's the answer to the question, like, what is the ethical right thing to do right now? You have to speak out against evil, right? You have to either hate it, and that's like the lowest level, right? And this is kind of a Muslim idea that, like,
right,
the
lowest level of hate it with your heart is the lowest degree of faith. Yeah.
Right. Yep. And this is not what's going to prevent it being spread in a society. So evil only spreads when people don't call it out, right? When they don't say something, if they see it and they just remain silent, then it spreads. That's what's happening right now. And, you know, a better thing would be to just change it yourself, right? Like, if you're the head of a school, just say like, okay, we're going to try to like go to our constituents and raise funds instead of depending on the federal government for funds. Or if you're like a sheriff in a sheriff's department, you know, and you're being called upon to do something you don't believe in, and, you know, it's like the money is what's leading you to do it, right? Like, the government can print whatever they want to, you know, further whatever agenda they want, which is basically, I think, one of the root causes of all evil in our society is the money printer, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And then a lot of the scientific, quote unquote, you know, scientific agendas, you know, scientistic agenda, I mean, they're not really scientific, but anyway, the research agendas, right? They all further government ideologies, and a lot of them are in the interests of trying to minimize the effects of inflation. Right. So inflation is the, you know, it's the elephant in the room that no one talks about. It's the real tax, right?
Taxes are going
hidden
up.
Tax.
Yeah.
Taxes are going up, but the real taxes are going through the roof, right? Because so it's, people don't realize that it's a tax on their wealth, right? And their income. It's the most pervasive, most regressive tax, you know, imaginable, because it, you know, it primarily affects people who are not wealthy, right? The wealthy are shielded from it because their asset prices go up with inflation, right? Their gold and their real estate stock.
Some would argue that like Michael Hudson's take is that there's this ages long battle between creditors and debtors, and that inflation isn't good, but somebody who is in a position to be a creditor is somebody who's amassed a lot of money, and they're holding on to that money, and inflation is a tax on their money. So inflation is basically a tax on wealth, and accumulated wealth is taxed more than a lot of wealth gets taxed more than a little wealth.
Right. So there's a difference between creditors, right, who have debt out in the world, and people who have their wealth in real estate and in the stock market or in companies or in gold or silver or like mines, you know, like real things. Those things will always, you know, be fine, right? Gold is always going to be worth something. And if our dollar gets inflated away to nothing, gold will be, you know, infinitely valuable in terms of dollars. And so any culture, right, any society that's gone through hyperinflation, I mean, certainly, you know, you can buy buildings for pennies on the dollar, but eventually, you know, once the, you know, society kind of resets, you know, you're going to be, that building is going to be worth something, right? If there's still a civilization there, if there's still a city there, people are going to need to rent it from you. And so if you have like real things instead of the paper, if you're somebody who just has paper, yeah, certainly you're going to be, you know, out of luck. If you hold a lot of debts that become worthless, certainly, right? So all of our creditor nations of the U.S., I mean, they are going to be left holding the bag eventually, right? Like there's always going to be default through inflation by inflating away the power of your currency. Once you go down this path, there's no way out of it, right? Like we have gone too far, right? Our debt has ballooned far more, you know, to a point that our GDP can't keep up with it, and we will eventually either default, you know, which is unlikely, or inflate our way out of it, right? So we'll pay it back in worthless, you know, paper. But the people who, you know, at least so far are fine are the ones who own real things, not the paper, right? Like they're not depending on the debt and the paper for their wealth. So they're not just, you know, bankers and all they have. But, you know, all of the wealthy, you know, some of their income, you know, I'm sure is in debt instruments and stuff like that. I mean, they spread it around, right? Like they all own a lot of land, right? A lot of real estate and a lot of real stuff, right? Like productive enterprises in the real world. You know, no one who is significantly wealthy only owns paper and debt.
Mm-hmm. Although a lot of wealth has gone into this kind of speculative casino of the, printing these new monetary instruments and, these various ways of speculating on debt. So the Wall Street paper economy has actually become bigger compared to the Main Street productive economy. I think your point is well taken. But I think the inflation issue does kind of cut both ways. And the people who have to pay back debt, which to some extent are people who borrow it to try to do productive activity with it, and in other cases are people who are poor enough that they need to borrow, they actually, when they pay back in inflated dollars, then they're actually getting off easy. And Hudson makes the point that debt jubilees are necessary, that if you don't have that, then in a compound interest system, all of the money is going to get sucked up into very, very, very few hands, just based on the laws of exponential mathematics. So I think there's something to that.
Right. So the obvious, like the cleanest system is obviously the Islamic banking system, where there is no, you know, interest, right?
Right.
You don't
right.
even have interest in the first place. Instead of having to, like, you know, take away somebody's right by, you know, having a debt jubilee every, you know, 50 or 100 years, you don't give them that, you know, it's not, you know, you don't give them that right in the first place to take, you know, on interest or to spend interest. So I think that's the cleanest solution, right? It's just to not have interest in the first place.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And, you know, that leads us to the topic of Islam actually having some really relevant answers to these things. I actually came to Islam back in the mid 90s. And one of the reasons I did was that I looked into it and saw that it jibed with my understanding of human nature that I'd gotten both from life experience and from reading anthropology and things like that. And there is a human nature. I think, you know, the Islamic revelation kind of gets it right. And gives us reasonable rules for dealing with it. And I wonder if you think that the whole, one of the problems with this trans ideology and so many other so-called modern ideologies is that they deny that there is any actual built-in sort of human nature. And they believe that you can just make people into anything you want. So it's easy to make a boy into a girl and vice versa. And that's kind of a satanic ideology, isn't it, of rising up against the creation that the way it is, and that we have to sort of radically change things. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah. So what that, you know, kind of reminds me of or brings up for me is a thought that I had recently, that Christianity really sowed the seeds of its destruction when it went down this Trinity pathway. Okay. This is, you know, intellectually unsatisfying. Okay. It doesn't make sense, right, to human beings that, you know, it's kind of like saying a man can be a horse, right? He's a man and he's a horse at the same time. It just doesn't make sense, right? So if you understand what the word God means, like what is God, like a one God, right? Like if you get the idea, it's completely nonsensical to say that God is a man, right? Like they are two completely different things that cannot be conjoined. It's just as ridiculous as saying a man is a horse, right?
Yeah. Well, one of my professors, right? Jacob Needleman, he said that it was a great Zen koan, right? Like an absurd thing that is so absurd that it just, you know, it freezes your mind, and then you can be open to transcendental experience. So maybe if, you know, people meditate on God as a man, then they have that one hand clapping kind of mystical experience. I don't know.
Right,
but to explain
further kind of the thought that I had, you know, this tradition, this, kind of like philosophical, you know, tradition in Western civilization of atheism, right? That never got going in the Islamic, you know, countries or in the Islamic tradition, right? They don't have this philosophical history of this atheistic idea, right? It never sprouted. It didn't have fertile ground to sprout, right? But it really built up steam in Western civilization. And I think it's because they left the door open by making this ridiculous claim. And then people just rejected religion outright, like just, you know, wholesale. They were just like, you know, this is, you know, I can't believe this, right? It just doesn't make sense. It's not realistic. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't compute. This was the seed of destruction, because atheism is really kind of like the core principle that opens the door to destroying, you know, Western civilization, or at least Western Christian civilization, and overthrowing it. And we're seeing that, you know, all of these kind of, you know, Marxist ideas and the Frankfurt School, all of this stuff has its, you know, origin in atheism and nihilism and, you know, all of these things, all of these ideas and relativism, you know, all these philosophies, they entered Western civilization through the door of atheism, which I think was left open because of the idea of the Trinity. And none of that stuff ever took hold in Muslim lands, because it's as pure of a it's just utterly pure monotheism, right? Like there, you know, you don't make any excuses, right? And you don't have to. It's, there's one God and that's it, you know, end of the story. And if you really start to understand the idea, and it takes some time, it's not something that you can really intellectually grasp, you know, overnight. It's more of like, it takes years to really understand it, and to live it. And to like, you know, and sometimes you have to like travel and you have to meet people and you have to like see how this works in the real world and how people really understand it. And so it took me like probably decades to really wrap my head around some of you know, I was born Muslim, but, you know, I grew up in the West and I grew up, you know, indoctrinated with all these Western ideas and Western schools. And then I went back to Pakistan and, you know, I lived there for 5-6 years. And I got to see what a Muslim, you know, an ancient Muslim civilization actually looks like from the inside, and how people there really understand monotheism and, you know, what one God means, and kind of, and then you start to slowly understand the wisdom behind things that at, you know, first glance seem to be utterly wrong to you, right? When you're coming from an alien culture, you know, like some of the ideas around, like, you know, men and women are completely different, right? And there's nothing wrong with being feminine, right? A woman should be feminine and a man should be masculine, right? And so, like, a lot of these, you get kind of brainwashed when you grow up in this culture. And the problem is the brainwashing is becoming so much worse with each passing generation. They're getting so much farther away from, like, true human nature, right? That the journey back is harder and harder to make. So it was hard enough for me to make the journey back to kind of, like, traditional, the understanding of the ancients and the, you know, traditional Islamic understanding, the traditional Islamic worldview. It was hard enough for me when I grew up, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But it's exponentially harder for Gen Z, right? Because of all these myths and things that they've been, you know, imbibing, right? Like they're just made up ideas, right? That people are, and again, they're being given to them, they're being fed to them at this age where you will believe anything that's told to you, right? You tell somebody there's a, you know, God is a man, or, you know, there's like somebody living in the sky, or there's a man in the moon, or there's, you know, Santa Claus, they just believe it, right? And if, you know, they grow out of the whole Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy thing, but they hold on to a lot of these other things, which they never realize, and they never, you know, consider them in any depth, right? And they don't realize, no one ever walks them through, like, how these things are incoherent, right? They make no sense when you really examine them, right, to any extent. And you can very easily, you know, take apart New Atheism, right? I mean, it just takes, like, maybe 20, 30 pages of, you know, something well-written, and you can just dismantle all their seemingly tight logical arguments, right? You discover that they are completely illogical, and they make a lot of logical fallacies. But kids aren't being taught that, right? They're just being given an ideology and told to believe it.
What do you think about the possibility that 9/11 was deliberately engineered, among other things, to launch the new atheism? You know, it was interesting how those books came out riding the wave of anti-Islam hysteria after 9/11, and it really did almost look like somebody had not only wanted to launch these various wars against Muslim countries to benefit various special interests, but also possibly to try to sort of change the history of ideas by trying to stop this kind of spread of Islam that was starting to be, you know, there was a very intense, heady atmosphere of Islamic thought in the 90s. And then, you know, this 9/11 public relations stunt smeared Islam and Muslims as a bunch of lunatic, you know, suicidal kamikazes and so on, terrorists. And then, you know, that's been used to push back against Islam ever since. And so I wondered if you had, you know, looked into that. And, you know, this, of course, has been my issue since the beginning of 2004. And so I'm just curious about, you know, what is your take on that?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of one of those chicken or egg questions, you know, like maybe there's just the time was ripe, you know, after that for some of these ideas to take hold. You know, I think that people discount just the very idea of conspiracies, right? And that's ridiculous, because everything, almost everything, anything that has any significant impact on reality or the world is a conspiracy of some kind, right? Like you could say Apple is a conspiracy, Google's a conspiracy, right? Like they wouldn't have any power in the marketplace if they didn't have a bunch of people going after one idea, you know, the same goals. So certainly, you know, conspiracies are the way that the world works. You know, that's how things get done in the real world. And you know, it's a CIA idea that's been seeded into us, that, you know, it's a tinfoil hat kind of thing, and it's ridiculous. You know, don't ever even consider that. You know, it just, you know, you hear something and you just say conspiracy theorist, and then you just turn off your brain, right? And you don't consider it. So I don't know. I mean, it's speculative, and, you know, I would say it's, I don't have any proof one way or the other. I haven't really thought about that particular question, but I think it's just important to keep your mind open and realize that conspiracy theories are the default mode of, you know, the way that men get things done, right? It's by, you know, entering into conspiracies with other people. And certainly there are, you know, forces that play in the world that are hidden from the vast majority of humanity. And it's helpful to kind of pull back the curtain and realize what's actually going on. So, I think it's a plausible, you know, theory.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you look into the sort of national security, international relations field, you quickly discover that history is full of all sorts of stuff that they don't tell you in your high school textbook. and that, you know, our side, the good guys, right, the axis of good, is not exactly, you know, the mythical force for benevolence that we've been told. How about the interfaith dimension of working with other people of faith against these bizarre sort of, you know, culture jacking agendas of cultural Marxism? It seems that the Christians haven't figured out that the Muslims are on their side and some, you know, some Jews as well. And that, as you said earlier, that we share a lot of things in common. You know, the Christians seem to be shocked when you tell them that, yeah, we Muslims say that, yeah, Jesus is the real Messiah and the right. Son of the Virgin Mary. And he's, you know, we're praying that he comes back and sets things right, just like you are. And they kind of go, really? I thought you hated Jesus. No, that's the Jews. but in terms of trying to bring people together on these things, and even the sort of the not so religious people, the people that didn't get a religious education, how do we get past this notion that it's like a parochial religious hang-up to, you know, to not like trans surgery being foisted on little kids?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's the you know, the thing that I tell, you know, Christians. I went to a church, you know, a few months ago, and that's what I told them, right? That, like, we love Jesus, and we're waiting for the Messiah to return, and we will fight alongside you, right? Like, we will all be united under one banner, the Muslims and the Christians, and I think, you know, I would say many of the Jews too. So I think you're exactly right. You have to point out our similarities. You know, what is the common thread, you know, amongst us. And it reminds me of this, it's a website and a movement called A Common Word. And it was a letter that was sent from a number of Muslim scholars to the Pope and a number of other Christian, you know, leaders around the world, you know, telling them, you know, what is, and it comes from a verse in the Quran, I think, where, or from a hadith or something, but where God says, you know, call them to a common word between, you know, us and you. So call them to a common word between, you know, the Muslims and the Christians, and that we, you know, belief in one God. And then I think love of the neighbor or something. I don't remember the exact details, but, you know, you have to find the commonalities and realize that the ethical basis of these religions is almost identical, right? They come from the same source. And their essential ethics are the same, despite some, you know, these minor differences in the way that they're put into practice. You know, sometimes I feel sorry for Christians, especially because they don't really have a strong law to fall back on, right? The way, like, Muslims, you know, it's a lot easier for us to deal with things like abortion because we have all these kind of rules around it, right? Like, we believe that the soul enters the body at a certain time. And like, all the details of the law are quite clear, right? And, you know, the vast majority of them, you know, obviously there's some differences of opinion in the modern world, you know, how you apply things to the modern world. But anyway, I mean, that's kind of a tangent. I mean, your main point in question, I don't see any other way other than somehow delivering the message to as many people as possible, right? Which is, I think, what you're trying to do and what a lot of people in alternative media are trying to do, is to deliver the message. And then the responsibility falls upon your listeners. If you've accepted the message and you believe, you know, then you need to spread it, right? It needs to be word of mouth. You know, it doesn't take much to spread one idea to the entire world, right? Like, if you tell, you know, 10 people and they tell 10 people and they tell 10 people, like, every day, it'll just take a couple of weeks before the entire world has heard this message. And so that's really, like, the responsibility falls upon the people who have heard it, and the responsibility of speaking out against evil falls upon the people who know that it's evil, right? Because the damage is not limited to your own self or your own life or your own family. The damage is universal, right? We're destroying humanity, and we're destroying future generations. These, you know, 10 to 40% of Gen Z who identify as LGBTQ, they're far less likely to have kids and reproduce and pass on, like, you know, historical ideals, right? And far less likely, if they do have kids, they're more likely to be dysfunctional adults, because we know that, you know, strong nuclear families are what, you know, lead to strong, independent, you know, healthy, happy, long-lived adults, you know, who make good money and get educated and have all the, you know, benefits of this life. And so the spread of this evil is harmful, and, you know, tremendously harmful. And you have to sit there, if you're not speaking up, you have to, I think, meditate on how far this evil, you know, how many people it affects. It just doesn't affect, you know, the people alive right now. It affects, you know, future generations, you know, down to the end of time, which is why seemingly, you know, things that seem only to harm you, they oftentimes harm, you know, many people beyond you. And then when they harm them, they affect people that they are interacting with. Like, so a simple example is, you know, people think that, you know, if I just do something, you know, in the privacy of my bedroom, in the middle of the night and no one knows about it, I'm just hurting myself, if anyone. But like, everyone carries around this judge inside them, right? Like, you judge yourself, before anyone else does. Right. And when you've judged yourself to have done something that you deep down know is wrong, that changes the way you interact with other people. Maybe you take it out in anger on your kids or something, right? You're actually angry at yourself for doing the wrong thing, but you're snappy with your kids. Then they grow up and they're snappy with their kids, and they're snappy with other people in their life around them. And so you're spreading these waves of evil spread out from you, right? And so, like, seemingly minor things can really have a tremendous impact on the world around you and on future generations. And when it's an idea like this, when it's a mind virus, right, that's extremely infectious, like these ideologies, they can just cause tremendous harm to people, and not just in this world, but in the next world. And so you have to sit there and consider the gravity of the situation, the tremendous nature of your reality, right? The effect you have on this world and the people in it, and how it affects their next world, right? Like, if you are spreading evil, right, then you are harming other people, not just in this life, but in the next life, right? Because they may, you know, for example, if you're a Muslim and you're going around and you're cheating people, you know, you're driving them away from Islam, right? If you're shouting at somebody when they're, you know, cutting you off, right? Like, you're driving them away from the truth and from what will be beneficial for them in the next life. So you're bringing them tremendous harm, right? You don't even realize it. So people need to sit there and consider, why is the punishment, you know, why are the punishments so severe? Why does hell exist, right? Like, why is the punishment for seemingly, you know, innocuous things so severe? It's so severe because it harms more than just you. It harms many, many people, right? It spreads out from you in ripples. And it affects, you know, everyone around you, and eventually it reaches the entire world, because those people interact with other people who interact with other people, and it especially affects your children and the people that come after you, you know, and the people that they raise. And just by that, right, like, if you just have, you know, a couple of kids, and they have a couple of kids, and they have a couple of kids each, right, like, you're talking about thousands of people within a few generations, you know, that you are affecting by what you do.
Right. Yeah, that's a point that gets raised when I talk with libertarian style Americans who say things like, you can't legislate morality. And of course, well, what are you legislating when you're legislating against theft, right, and murder and rape and so on? But you're legislating morality. But as you say, these other moral issues are not entirely private.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, this is the big problem, because you know, a generation ago, maybe, or even before that, people got convinced that, you know, as long as it's kind of private, it's not a big deal, right? The other big problem along these lines is the way that the language was slowly changed. So what used to be looked down on and called sodomy was then relabeled sex, right? And then from accepting it as sex, then you accept marriage, right? And so it's the same.
And that's like
the
it's a sacrament. They can't. The medical doctors can't even advise these gay men not to do it in a monkeypox epidemic, because that would be sort of blaspheming against this sacrament of homosexual activity, which we're all supposed to kowtow to.
Yeah, and the other thing, right, like with this trans ideology in you know, elementary schools, I mean, they're telling kids about anal sex. I mean, could you imagine 20 years ago telling like 4 or 5 year olds about anal sex? I mean, I couldn't imagine being exposed to even the idea, right? I don't know when I learned that it was a thing. I mean, probably in my teens, maybe. I don't know. Like, I'm glad I didn't know about it. But now, like, kids are being told about this and they're like practicing it, right? Like, they're doing it in the bathroom stalls with each other when they're like 9, 10 years old. I mean, it's just utterly disgusting what we're doing. And this doesn't even get into, you know, what, you know, the things we're doing to their bodies and their health and their, you know, their future health and hacking off body parts and mutilation. I mean, the direction this society is going, I don't know. Has any society ever become this depraved? I mean, I don't know. I mean,
maybe Sodom and Gomorrah, maybe. We're heading in that direction anyway. Oh, boy. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I know it would have been interesting also to talk about your approach to health and medicine, but with only 2 minutes, I'm not sure how much of that we can talk about. Maybe you could at least tell people where to go to find out about that.
Yeah, so it's mygotodoc.com, mygotodoc.com. You can look me up online, and you'll find my website as well, my name. Dr. Syed Haider. The great thing about it, I think the most beneficial thing about it is people can register for free as a patient in my practice. You can upload your, kind of your medical information, fill out a medical form, and then I can give you free medical advice. So if you have questions, if you want to know what's really going on, you know, in terms of the pandemic or the plandemic or the casedemic or the coming monkeypox scare, you can ask us and we'll give you free medical kind of answers and advice.
That's fantastic. Are you getting any pushback from this? I know that like Meryl Nass, another medical doctor radio guest, has gotten severe pushback. Are you facing any of that?
So I have gotten a bunch of, you know, spurious complaints from medical boards, which I was able to get rid of, thank God. So 4 or 5 medical boards kind of came after me, you know, things that they never would have come after me for, you know, ever before, you know, like ivermectin prescribing and stuff. So that's the extent of it so far. So I've mostly been flying under the radar, and kind of, you know, you have to be independent nowadays as a physician, and you have to kind of like know how to kind of shield yourself in some of these things. So far I've been lucky, thank God. So, you know, everyone keep me in your prayers.
Alhamdulillah. Keep up the great work, Dr. Syed Haider. I appreciate your frank free speech and your, I think, very well-considered opinions. And I hope and pray that people will be able to keep speaking freely about these subjects. So good luck, God bless, and look forward to talking again down the line.
Thank you. Thanks. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. It's Dr. Syed Haider. I'm Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio, bringing on Adam Green of No More News to discuss his Rabbis Explain the Abrahamic Judeo Takeover Conspiracy video. That sounds interesting. Stick around for that.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Fripp Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Riff, Ivan. Thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking to controversial people about controversial topics, stuff that you're not allowed to talk about on social media or at your mother's dinner table. Well, that was a great first hour with Syed Haider, and now we're moving on to more discussions of the, well, what do we call it, the culture wars issues. First hour, we were pretty much on the side of the Abrahamic Judeo takeover conspiracy in its culture war with the cultural Marxists. Now we're going to talk with Adam Green, who is a critic of that Abrahamic Judeo takeover conspiracy, a different point of view. He's got a new video out about it, and it's pretty interesting with some pretty wild and crazy quotes from rabbis, from Donald Trump, from Alan Dershowitz. And boy, you could actually fuel an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory with these kinds of quotes. So let's get into it with Adam. Hey, welcome back, Adam. How are you?
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing? I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Good to have you back. It's been a while, and you're still chugging along, putting out provocative, interesting stuff. This latest video, it starts out with rabbis confessing that Jews want to control the world. Where do they get off saying things like that? Don't these rabbis know that that's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory?
I know. This really is like the open conspiracy that they don't want you to talk about. You know, they're conspiracies of – but where are we streaming right now? Is this on YouTube?
No, we're on revolution.radio. And okay. Eventually we will be on other places, but not YouTube, because YouTube cannot handle this kind of honest conversation.
That's why I was just wanted to make sure, you know, so I could
say whatever you think.
cater to the censorship. Yeah. So basically the Torah Abrahamic Judeo conspiracy is to take over the world basically by theologically conquering the nations. All their prophecies and their goal, they're chosen to be a light unto the nations and to spread the law to the nations and to subdue the nations. And basically, my view is that, and not just my view, but top rabbis all throughout history, like 12th century Maimonides, say that both Christianity and Islam are the fulfillment of those prophecies to make all of the nations, all of the goyim, worship the God of Israel and believe in the patriarchs also. And like I said, top Rabbi Maimonides in the 12th century said this. He says this is the fulfillment of that prophecy, and it's preparing the world for the Messianic age. The Christianity and Islam basically eradicated all of the so-called pagan idol-worshipping religions and cultures and traditions of people, the nations all over the world, and replaced it with the worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel, that chose the Jews of the Torah.
No, there's no mention of Yahweh in the Quran or in Islamic tradition whatsoever.
Right. Well, but Islam is of the Abrahamic beliefs. It believes in the Abrahamic patriarch.
That's true, but Yahweh...
In the covenant.
Yahweh was originally a henotheistic idol or god among many gods. Henotheism is the precursor to monotheism, when you believe, you know, that there are many gods, but your tribal god is your god, right? And so that's what Yahweh originally was. And I would argue that he never really got past that, whereas Christianity and Islam are radically, radically different. They worship a universal god. They don't worship a henotheistic tribal idol called Yahweh, and that's why they're not tribalistic. Like, Jews kind of worship their own tribe, and that leads to all these problems that Euro was dissecting. But Christians and Muslims, no, they don't. They believe in a universal God. It's the God of everyone. And Christians, yeah, it's very complicated. In Islam, it's really clear that the only difference of, you know, hierarchy or gradation, or, you know, one person being above another, is the degree of piety and good works. So there's a huge difference, really, between a tribal god, Yahweh, and the universal god of Christianity and especially Islam.
Well, I completely agree that Yahweh came from Canaanite religions and other religions that preceded Judaism. And I agree that it is a tribal god, and I'll argue it still is the tribal god of the Israelites, of God's chosen people, his holy seed that are a treasure to him and the apple of his eye, clearly supremacist, although the rabbis try to deny it with plenty of pilpul. But, you know, like top rabbis say that Islam is a Noahide compliant religion because it believes in no idols but the oneness of God, and it is the God of Abraham. So it's...
Well, good for them. God bless those rabbis. What's wrong with that?
Well, that was their objective all along in the Torah and in the Talmud, which preceded the creation of Islam. And when the rabbis believe that the Arabs are the descendants of Ishmael, and then a religion pops up where they adopt that same belief that they are from Abraham and Ishmael. And remember, Ishmael, according to Islam, is the impure twin, basically. There's a theme in the Bible with Cain and Abel, even God and Satan, of this dualism. And then it goes on to Jacob and Esau. The Jews and rabbis believe that Esau is Christianity and ancient Rome before that. And then now the European West represents Esau and Edom. And then they believe that basically that is the antithesis to Jacob, the Jews. And then they believe the same thing with Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael as well. So these are the two, from the point of the Jews, like the kind of Judaism for the Gentiles, for two different groups of Gentiles that they've often throughout history pinned them against each other. Mm-hmm. And in the end times, they believe Gog and Magog will be where Ishmael and Esau wage war against one another and mutually destroy each other, where only God's chosen people survive.
Yeah, no, I think you're largely right about that, at least with a certain strain of Jewish thought. That's true. But, of course, that is merely the perspective of those that particular strain of Jewish thought, and it is not an accurate description of Islam and Christianity by a long shot. It's a kind of a self-serving Jewish tribalistic view that attempts to force these great monotheistic religions into this little template of this Jewish kind of historical plan. And so I don't think we should accept that that's all it is. I think that you know, sort of seeing Christianity and Islam as a Jewish conspiracy really misses the fact that the reason that some of these Jewish thinkers, especially these apocalyptic messianic sort of Jewish thinkers, have come up with this plot to pit the Christians and the Muslims against each other in the end times So they'll kill each other off to pave the way for the Messiah to rule the world and elevate the Jews to their top position that they deserve, which, of course, that is a long-standing theme. Abarbanel, the idol of Netanyahu's father, who wrote a book on him, is one of the leading thinkers along those lines, who he actually thought he could start that war between the Christians and the Muslims back 500 years ago. And he thought he could pit the Ottomans against the Christians. And so, yeah, that thought exists, but that doesn't mean that if we're objectively trying to understand what our Christianity and what is Islam, that we should ourselves reduce those great religions, which are vastly bigger and greater, more universal, and in many ways, I would say, much richer and more sophisticated and accurate than Judaism. We shouldn't reduce them to this impoverished view that these particular rabbis try to impose on them.
Well, you know, to say that it's more accurate than Judaism kind of implies that Judaism is somewhat accurate. And I think when in Islam, when you affirm the patriarchs and the stories of that they share in common in the Torah, when you also circumcise, when the Christians are following the Jewish Messiah and the Muslims also believe in Jesus as a prophet. And it, the goal before Christianity and Islam, long before Islam and Christianity existed, the goal was to subdue the nations. All the goyim will worship and be slaves, basically, or destroyed to the God of Israel. That was the goal, and their means to accomplishing that was to converting the Gentiles not to be Jews and follow Judaism, because they don't want them to do that. They must be kept separate, must keep the holy seed separate. So they converted them to these basically like quasi like antithesis religions. It's basically like the, you know, let me finish this point. Okay. Their go-to method for control is always controlling the opposition. So they basically coerced the Gentiles into worshiping their God, fulfilling their prophecy.
Okay, so you're saying that when Christianity spread originally in the Roman Empire, it was being sort of covertly pushed by Jewish rabbis who didn't believe in it, but who rather were framing it as a kind of a fictional belief that they were trying to sell to Gentiles. I wonder how you would see that when Islam spread. You're right, with Christianity, that was happening within a Jewish community to a certain extent. So Christianity at its birth may have sort of been a real offshoot of Judaism. Islam, on the other hand, not so much. I mean, Islam begins with a real struggle between the Muslims and the Jews of Medina. And the Quran is not very complimentary to Jews in general.
Neither is the Bible. That's part of the scam.
What does the Bible have to do with it?
Well, when they believe Christianity is Esau and Judaism and the Jews is Jacob, the prophecies are that Esau hates Jacob. And this was where they get their belief that there are chosen to be hated. And God basically punishes them through the persecutory agent of Esau. Not so much Ishmael. Ishmael is actually it's influenced by Judaism and Christianity. And it's basically a more improved version of Christianity. It's more Noahide compliant. But
but what's the evidence that Jews spread either of these religions? I'm more of an expert on Islam. Mm-hmm. And as I see it, there's absolutely no evidence that Jews were pushing Islam, that the birth of Islam and the spread of early Islam was being sold by Jews.
Right. Well, with Christianity, it's Paul the Pharisee is the oldest documents of Christianity that we have. And you can see where he basically just had visions. And he doesn't even claim to ever have met Jesus. But he said that he saw him in visions. And really what he did was read all throughout the prophecies of the Old Testament and other books that didn't get included in the canon and find little prophecies here and there and like in a new midrash, they came up with new myths that fulfill the prophecies of the Old Testament from books like Isaiah and Daniel and Zechariah and Wisdom of Solomon and the Psalms and many others. And they came up, they formed a new, fabricated and constructed a new fake Jewish fulfillment of prophecies and then sold it to the Gentiles.
Well, I could see how you could make that argument if you were focusing on the Old Testament pounding Protestants, who in many ways do seem to be like almost junior partners of Jews, in, especially in their Zionist endeavors. I don't see that with Islam, however, because in Islam we have a doctrine that says that these earlier scriptures are not perfectly transmitted. They're not entirely accurate. And so Muslims traditionally have not really gone to the earlier scriptures, I think, as much as they should. I mean, I think we should be reading them critically, recognizing that they're not accurately transmitted. And so we can look and see what things in them jibe with our understanding, as it's corrected by the Quran or not. But again, this theory that somehow, the Quran's take on the prophets of the Bible is in some ways different. You know, it corrects a lot of these stories in a moral direction. There are kind of moral problems in some of these biblical stories. Job being hideously tortured with God's connivance as God makes a bet with Satan, and then crying out in against God and so on. Whereas in the Quranic version, he suffers and he's rewarded, just like we all are rewarded for our sufferings. And so Joseph, rather than being somebody who bought up all of the grain supply in order to make a huge profit during a famine or a drought, as some readings of the biblical story might have it, is a pure, spotless, and moral individual. And on and on and on. So the Quran is teaching consistent universal morality. And that's quite different, really, from what the Old Testament teaches. The Jews, who have now become a tiny minority of monotheists, have had great problems, of course, with Christians and now Muslims with the Zionist invasion of Palestine. I think seeing these two universal monotheisms as a Jewish conspiracy, as having been concocted and spread by some group of Jews for their own purposes, I think that actually takes these quotes that you've gathered in your video, which are a very interesting bunch of quotes, all very different from each other, and I think it really distorts them on a Procrustean bed, makes them say things they don't really say. But I mean, maybe you could go on and sort of elaborate on how you see these universal monotheisms participating in this Jewish messianic millenarian conspiracy to create a one world Jewish ruled state.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you take a step back, their prophecies were that the whole world would worship their God and the law will come forth from Zion. And basically, through Christianity and Islam, they Judaized the world by getting them to believe in the God of Abraham. And does Islam not believe that the Jews are the quote, people of the book?
The traditionally, people of the book has referred to Jews and Christians. And of course, Abraham is one of the prophets mentioned in the Quran. The Quran mentions many of the prophets from the Torah and quite a few prophets that are not in the Torah, mostly Arab prophets. But the idea is that all prophets are transmitting God's message, which is pretty much the same in all cases. It's a message of morality, universal morality, and universal worship of the one God. And there's no tribe, there's no hierarchy, nobody's better than anybody else in this duty that we have and this test that we're undergoing to see if we can joyfully submit ourselves to the one God and creator of all things. And that's that universal dimension and that moral dimension. And then finally, the spiritual dimension. All of those things are very different, really, from most Judaism. That is, the spiritual dimension being that the spiritual life is really what's important, not material life. So salvation is in the Akhira, the hereafter, the other world, whereas in Judaism, salvation comes through progeny in this world, because all success is this world, and the next world is just Sheol, this sort of dark, damp place underground where nothing really happens. Basically, it's just your grave. So they're you know, in being universal, moral, and spiritual, Islam and to a great extent Christianity are really radically different from Judaism, and I don't think they're anything that the Jewish rabbis really would have wanted to create.
Well, they've always, many of them have always boasted about it and taken credit that the nations, the Goyim, which were idol worshippers and you know, had multiple gods. And I agree. Well, this is what they say, is their goal was to bring monotheism to the world. They were chosen to bring monotheism, the god that chose them, which is the catch. You know Laurent Guyonnet, right?
Yeah, yeah. I translated Laurent Guyonnet's book on this, From Yahweh to Zion. And I agree with a lot, you know, maybe 80, 90% of Laurent's critique. And it's totally compatible with Islam and presumably Christianity, too.
Yeah, also his book, Our God is Your God Too, But He Has Chosen Us. He has a few chapters right. about this same exact topic. It was actually... You know, I use some of his arguments quite frequently, but
right, but see, the Jews, they can say that, but we don't have to believe it. Like, as a Muslim, I know that God is universal for everybody. There's no group that's better than any other group. The Jews are not special. In fact, in thinking that they're special, they're actually problematic. They're singled out as a very problematic group in the Quran. The Christians are the people who are going to be our friends and the people who say we are Christians, whereas the Jews and the idolaters or polytheists, those are the people you have to watch out for.
Right. In Judaism, paganism is basically just anybody that's not worshiping the God of Israel. And it's funny that you brought up the story of Joseph in Genesis, because this is the template that they use to frame the first coming of the Messiah. In Judaism, they've always believed in two messiahs, because God creates the light and the darkness, and it's all about this dualism, you know, Hegelian dialectic, controlled opposition thing. So they have an evil messiah and a good messiah, basically, is one way to look at it. And Jesus is following the template. The first coming, the suffering messiah, is Moshiach ben Joseph. He's the one that suffers and atones for the sin, and it's following the template of Joseph in the Bible. It's the Messiah, son of Joseph. And Joseph is, like Jesus, rejected by his brothers, rejected by the Jews, and then is sold into slavery in a foreign land in Egypt, which in the Bible at that time represents basically the Gentile nations, the empire of the Gentiles. And he rose to be the power behind the throne and basically, you know, enslave the Egyptians. And this is metaphorically how the Jews used the suffering Messiah that they supposedly rejected in these memes. There's no real rejection. In my opinion, it's completely a fictional construct just derived from these different motifs and themes from the Old Testament. And so this so-called rejection that Christians get so angry about, that the Jews rejected their Messiah that was intended to come and conquer the Gentiles and bring vengeance to them. And essentially that is what Jesus did, because he theologically conquered. The Jews could never win militarily against these much greater empires, but they could win with psychological warfare and theological spiritual battle, which is what they did. And they, through Jesus, they convinced the non-Jews to worship the Messiah that was initially meant to conquer them, and was effective that way, because through Christianity and Islam, which both uphold Jesus, they have half of the world believing in the Abrahamic myths, which was their goal all along.
So you think they're doing this for ideological, religious purposes? It's not so much that they think that they're going to be ruling the world more easily if they have Jews and Christians out there in the world, but you're saying that it's that they believe in one God, they believe it's their God, but he's also supposed to be the God of the other people too, but they're the Chosenites, and so they're just happy to have other people worshiping this version of their God, right? So if that's the case, so what? Why not let them just be happy?
what's wrong with the Jews wanting to theologically conquer the world and having them be happy about it?
What do you mean? What does theologically conquer the world mean? I mean, if
like religion, if you see religion as a form of control, which it's always been used to control people, then if like look at how the Christian Zionists today are being controlled by in serving Israel and serving their aims. There would if without Christianity, there would be no Christian Zionism.
No, I disagree.
And they want the whole world to be Noahides, which basically they admit that the Jews are chosen by God and follow their God and are here to serve them. That's what they intend on happening, and the Christians are fulfilling that for them.
Well, you know, Christian Zionism is very far from traditional Christianity. Even Protestantism, to some extent, is with its worship of the Old Testament. But you know, the Rothschilds had to hire Cyrus Schofield, the medicine swindler and horse thief or whatever he was, barely literate, but somehow published this Schofield Bible through Oxford University Press, being funded by friends of the Rothschilds.
That's Untermeyer, right? Untermeyer.
Yeah, Untermeyer, right? Yeah. So that's they did manage to con a certain group of very unsophisticated Protestant Christians into becoming, Bible thumpers, right. Schofield Bible thumpers for their Zionist project. But it seems to me in the larger picture, I think what you're missing, Adam, is like you're sort of seeing all of this, this congruity and this, all the Abrahamic religions are going along with this Jewish plan for world conquest. I don't see that. I think it's the opposite. I think that actually what you see is that, going back several centuries, you see that the arrival of the self-styled Antichrist, Shabtai Zvi, who's a spinoff from the Jewish tradition. But you remember these rabbis, they all, 10 rabbis, 11 opinions, or maybe 9 rabbis, 11, whatever it is. The rabbis have a lot of different views and are always quarreling with each other. But Shabtai Zvi created a huge split in the Jewish community when he declared himself Messiah and called on the Jews to go back to Palestine with him. And then, of course, he nominally converted to Islam to save his head after he was arrested by the Sultan, and his followers then followed him into crypto-Islam and became the Danmeh group. So that group then is said to have been crucial in the formation of these satanic and esoteric quasi-Freemasonic currents behind the Rothschild banking empire and various other power centers. So those people are trying to, fulfill some sort of messianic millenarian prophecy, but more from an actual satanic perspective. And they're conning the worshipers of the one God into going along with them. And so I would argue that today Zionism is obviously not Jewish. Prior to World War II, the vast majority of the rabbinical establishment worldwide agreed that Zionism was heretical and if not satanic. And it was only after the shock of the so-called Holocaust that we got this kind of majority of rabbis agreeing that Zionism was an okay Jewish thing. I would argue they were wrong, that it's a satanic project. It's not even Jewish. Nature Karda is right. And so what we really have is a war between Satanists and followers of God. And the Zionists are the Satanists. And on the other side, you have the Christians, the Muslims, and Jews like Nature Karda, who are worshipers of God. And that I should then frame within the larger framework of worshiping the one God, and Abraham sort of being the prototype of that, is a good thing, not a bad thing, as you seem to imply sometimes. And one of the ways that we can see that it's a really good thing is that it ends paganism, which, as René Girard showed in his brilliant anthropological works, is all based on human sacrifice. And so this Abrahamic tradition of monotheism is all about putting an end to this ubiquitous practice of human sacrifice and the big lies that attend human sacrifice, which has always been the mechanism by which human societies, which up until then were always pagan societies, hold themselves together. They turn on somebody and lynch them. They turn on an innocent and preferably a pure and holy person and lynch them and then build a statue to them. That becomes a pagan god. And this is the way that all pagan societies have always operated. And monotheism, as Ray Gerard showed us, puts an end to that. So what we have here is that Satanism is a sacrificial cult. It wants the most brutal and horrific sacrifices possible, and that's what they want to rebuild the temple to do. And then the Antichrist will be indeed doing that, rebuilding the temple, carrying out horrific sacrifices, whether in the temple or wherever they carry out their human sacrifices of children. That's their thing. And so that what we're seeing here is not some sort of Jewish plan to conquer the world. The real issue we have here is a satanic plan to conquer the world on behalf of Satan. And, you know, paganism is also satanic. This, again, it's all based on human sacrifice. So I'm sure you don't agree with that perspective, but there it is.
So what you just said at the end there, that it's not a Jewish sacrifice plan, that it's a Satanist plan?
Yes, absolutely.
So the Jews aren't at fault here, and it's not
the
Torah
the Jews
and
are at
the
fault.
Supremacists. Jews.
No. See, built-in problems with Judaism having to do with the people that we call Jews today are the people who, rather than in basically embracing universal monotheism, as taught by all of the prophets, and then most obviously Jesus and Muhammad, peace upon both of them, rather than embracing universal monotheism, which is the one true correct religion and always has been, has always been the religion of the pure holy people who have opposed human sacrifice in pagan societies throughout all of human history, rather than embracing that pure, spotless, universal monotheism and self-surrender, ecstatic self-surrender to the one and only God, these people hung on to this henotheistic tendency to worship my God, my tribal idol, among a world of many tribal idols. So they're actually still a little bit pagan in that respect. They're henotheistic, and that egotistical clinging to, you know, the Satan, his motto is I am better than him, right? That's a Quranic line. And those people we call Jews today are people who clung to that egotistical feeling that they're better than others, that they're the chosenites, that they're the ones, you know, their God is everybody else's too, but they're special, right? And that kind of egotism actually is the opposite of the total surrender to God that is the right path and always has been. So, yeah, there's a problem in Judaism that Lauren Guyonneau documents beautifully that led to these problems. But what we're seeing today with Zionism and all of these other isms, these spin-offs from Messianic Millenarian and largely Jewish Messianic Millenarian thought, communism, cultural Marxism, on all these attempts to tear down the world and then rebuild the world as a perfect world by destroying gender categories, by using massive technology to pave the earth and just change everything, rebuild a whole new world, air condition the planet, yada, 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 all of this kind of stuff to destroy the God's natural world that God created and gave us. We're supposed to love the world and love God. Instead, we hate the world. We hate God. We rebel. We tear everything down. We build an artificial paradise, quote unquote, which is actually a hell on earth. I mean, this is all satanic. It's not Judaism. And obviously, it's not even, you know, humanistic. This is all satanic. So that's, I think, the problem. And the problem is Satanism. And the problem with Judaism is that it never overcame that little spark of satanic egotism.
You mentioned Schofield and Darby. Like, I agree with you. It's not disputable that that's when Christian Zionism in America really took off. And yes, it was funded by Untermeyer and top Zionist. But Christian, the beliefs and the prophecies of the Jews returning to the land, there's quotes from top pastors going back to the 1500s and the 1700s. So there was always the desire to fulfill God's prophecy to return the Jews to the Holy Land, and in order for Jesus to ultimately return and have the Jews convert. So it didn't just start with Schofield, and it was almost like a time capsule, and getting the Gentiles to believe in the Torah and believe in Jewish prophecies is that was the Trojan horse into getting them to ultimately turn into the advocates. That's the other thing, is that Esau and even through the Yom Kippur Kabbalah rituals reveal that Esau is meant to go from the persecution of the Jews to the advocates of the Jews. And this is how we see the history of Christian anti-Semitism, which has kept the Jews separate and kept them believing in their books that they're chosen, and kept them fearful and hateful of the Gentile. And it's also given them their victim status and their divine holy atonement and turned Gentiles really into the villains. They've scapegoated us as the villains in this whole story. And you mentioned Satanism a bunch of times. The Jews have always believed that Christianity is a form of Satanism. They believe in this dualistic nature. Christianity is Esau. Esau represents the darkness, the Sitra Atra, the evil other side. And Jesus is essentially the adversarial Messiah to the Jews, right? Mm-hmm. He is there. This is why they say that he's boiling an excrement in hell and that he is idol worship. He is tempting the Jews to idol worship. This is the role that Satan plays in Judaism. He's the tempter and the prosecutor and the punisher. And these are all roles that Jesus has fulfilled through Christianity. And, you know, you always hear the Jews complaining that Christians believe that they're satanic and that they're the synagogue of Satan because it says these things in the Bible. So the Bible that the Jews gave to the Gentiles, but really they actually believe that Esau and Ishmael are satanic and our souls come from the three satanic spheres of the Sitra Atra, the evil other side.
Yeah, and so those are examples of these bits of, I would call it, you know, Satanism or whatever. They're wrong teachings that were clung to by these people who had to feel themselves better than others. Again, the Satan's motto is, I am better than him. And yeah, those seeds of problems in the teachings that were retained by the people who called themselves Jews, as opposed to those who became universal monotheists and generally became Christians or Muslims, although I think there are people who practice a universal monotheism within Judaism as well, that kind of school of thought then led to all of these sorts of problems. So yeah, I agree with that part. But again, I think that you're giving these rabbis too much credit by, you know, they're sort of like,
look at the power they have
rooster,
today.
The
though.
Rooster taking credit for the sunrise. Okay, hey, we're the ones who created these. You know, we made three and a half.
They call us cattle, Christians proudly say that they're sheep.
Yeah, I mean they can say what they want, but they today.
Look at their power that they have. Look at their power. What else would you explain that gave them that power? If not that half the world believes that they were once chosen by God and that they have a covenant with God.
Oh, I think their power. Well, when we talk about Jewish power today, I don't think it's mostly even religious power. I think that historically, the disproportionate power that the so-called Jewish communities seem to hold, primarily in the West. Not so much in Asia, not so much in the Islamic world, but here in the formerly Christian West, I think that power actually doesn't come from the Jewish religion or the Jewish religion's manipulation of any other religion. What it comes from, on the contrary, is the decline of religion in the West, specifically the decline of Christianity. And what we see in the Jewish community is Jews not encouraging Christianity and certainly not encouraging Islam. We see them encouraging secularism from the get-go, from as secularism starts to develop in the West, the first people pushing
not religious Jews. Not religious Jews.
Right.
And, the Jewish community, Jewish identity is completely built upon the Torah. There would be no Jewish people and Jewish identity if not, it's all predicated on the Torah.
Right. But see, the Jewish community in the West rose from a position where it was considerably less powerful than today to a more powerful position over the past two, three, four centuries, mainly because of this process of secularization, which the Jews pushed. And the intellectual currents and the secret societies and so on that were pushed to encourage secularism, Freemasonry obviously, have had a really disproportionate Jewish component. And the Jews had every reason to try to secularize modern Western society because that led them then to – once you got a secular Enlightenment-based society, then Jews were emancipated, they're called. So instead of being locked up in the Pale of Settlement, being locked up in the ghettos, being prevented from going into certain professions, suddenly they can do any darn thing they want. And because of their ethnic nepotism, their chosenness syndrome – their extreme ethnocentrism, and to some extent probably maybe a 10 point or so IQ edge over non-Jews, which actually can become, percentage-wise, that can actually give them, when you talk about the really high IQ people who actually make things happen, there's going to be a pretty serious disproportion there with the Jewish population. They consciously did this by breeding their smartest rabbinical students with the daughters of the bankers and the merchants. And so for all of these reasons, a Jewish elite, ethnically Jewish, but not very religious, that was encouraging secularism, this main ideology was secular, has actually dominated the West now for two centuries.
So I think those are the
people who are taking over the world, not the religious Jews. The religious Jews, these rabbis that you're showing us, they're crowing and they're bragging and they're braying like donkeys, but they're not taking over anything. It's the bankers and the secular people and the atheists who are actually in charge.
Chabad Lubavitch is one of the most powerful religious Jewish organizations in the world. It was reported in New York Times back in the 90s. They were bringing in $100 million a year. Many of the top Jewish billionaires are meeting with them and getting their kosher stamp of approval in the Jewish community. They have huge influence with Likud, also with, through Jared Kushner and in politics with Trump. And they're all for Christianity. They're against secularism. They have the common enemies of the pagans, basically. They constantly tout the Judeo-Christian values. And Christians, Jews have like a love-hate relationship with Christianity, just like Christians have a love-hate relationship with Jews. And they basically need each other. They're both caught in a Judeo construct where it's two opposing Christian sects arguing about who the Messiah is. So it's all basically Judeo at the end of the day, and they've always been targeting Gentiles. Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles. He targeted the Gentiles with this belief in Jesus, and without Christianity, I don't think there would be a state of Israel today without Christian Zionism supporting them. And I think the key to their influence is not just that they believe they're chosen, but through the power of Christianity and their prophecies, and their rabbis say that they used the Roman Empire, they subverted it with this religion and spread that religion all over the world. And now the rabbis are bragging throughout history and today that this is all fulfillment of their goals.
Well, if you think the biggest power center in the world is Chabad Lubavitch, well, maybe. But when I look at...
The biggest in the world, but they are... I don't think anybody would dispute they're one of the most powerful organizations in the world. It's like an international mafia.
Yeah, they're certainly one of the mafias out there. But when I look at... I would try to figure out, so who's really the establishment? Who's at the top of the world power pyramid today? The kinds of institutions I would look at would be the Davos crowd. The New York Times would be expressing the view, and the Washington Post to some extent, and the other mainstream media outlets that follow them. The worldview that you get from the New York Times, Washington Post, the liberal intellectual worldview that you get from the universities, that is the de facto religion of the vast majority of the current elite. And that religion is secular, humanist, materialist progressivism. It has nothing to do with any Abrahamic monotheism.
What about the Abraham Accords going on as well? And also, you would agree the American Empire is like the most dominant empire in the world. And the Jews have always believed that America and the Christian West is the new Rome. They are Edom. And so Christianity, there's more Christians in America. It's the number one evangelical Zionist Christians is the number one religion. Almost 9 out of 10 people in Congress identify as Christian. So they're all affirming Jewish prophecies, the Jewish patriarchs, and the Torah. And that's powerful. And that's why America is Israel's greatest slave. An ally. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember Barry Shamish coming on my show a few times. He's a religious Jew who got into trouble with some of the Israeli authorities and then some of the international Jewish authorities. And he always thought that, you know, the sort of, there was a religious Jewish current, of course, in Israel. But when Israel was founded, he agreed with the majority of historians, I believe, that the founders of Israel were basically atheists. Now, they did read the Old Testament as a kind of epic history of their illustrious forebears of their tribe, the same way that, you know, a Greek might read the Odyssey, or West African, you know, might read the Sunjata epic. But they were far from religious. They were far from actually believing in God. And the, you know, people like Ben Gurion and the other founders of Israel, and indeed Theodor Herzl and other founders of Zionism, were atheists. They're all atheists. And the likewise, the actual elites who are running the show, it seems to me, have been increasingly atheists since the 19th century. A.N. Wilson's book, God's Funeral, documents the loss of religious faith among Western elites during the 19th century. And so what we have today is that the elite is again, secular, progressivist, materialist, you know, Freemasonic, to the extent there's any cult there. And Freemasonry is largely a, you know, disproportionately Jewish attempt to turn Christians into secularists. And, you know, why, you may ask, do the Jews want to turn
Noahides
secularists? Because they have a problem with Christians. They have a problem with Muslims, but not so much with secularists, because then they can compete on equal terms and dominate the society. And Jews have thrived in the secular societies. They didn't thrive in the religious societies. They never have, never will. They're never really dominated. They've done okay in Muslim societies, but they haven't dominated them the way they dominate the secular West. So the Jews have engineered the secularization. These, in secular Jews,
is the West really secular, Jews, though?
Have
Christianity has dominated
over
the West.
So you've had it actually backwards. It's, I think that the, rather than purveying the religion to take over the world, nominal Jews who were actually atheists have taken over the world by secularizing the world, depriving Christians and to some extent Muslims of their religious heritage, which actually would have protected them from this world takeover attempt.
Well, many rabbis are against secularism and want everybody following a monotheistic God, which is their God in their opinion. They want everybody to be Noahides. That's the goal. Not atheist. And I mean, Israel was founded by some atheist players, but there would have been no Zionism if not for Judaism. It's completely it wouldn't have been a thing. There would have been no desire to return to any holy land if not for the Bible and for Judaism. And there was other prior Kabbalah Zionist movements in the 1700s with the Gaon of Vilna, one of the top Kabbalah rabbis. Also, Ben Gurion and Herzl, these people may have not literally believed the Bible as historical fact, but they were still greatly influenced by these Jewish, you know, even allegorical myths. They're still influenced their decision making. And there's even plenty of Ben Gurion quotes saying that this is like prophecy fulfilling and, you know, based off the prophecies and stuff like that. And also there was a, you mentioned earlier, there was ultra-Orthodox Jews that were anti-Zionist at the time, because there's, you know, Jews have different opinions. Some believe that they're meant to do the work and hasten the Messiah themselves. Gaon of Vilna was one of those rabbis that believed they need to go back and build the temple and resettle the land, and then the Messiah would come. Whereas other rabbis, like Natura Karta, believe that the Messiah is supposed to come and lead them back. But at the end of the day, they're really still Zionists. They still believe in that they're chosen. They still believe that they will return to the land one day and fulfill the prophecies of being God's chosen people and basically, you know, ruling the world. The prophecies of the Old Testament of them being the master race to rule the world are just the most supremacist things. I'm sure you know, the most supremacist things you've ever seen. So I see this idea not just with you, but with a lot of people, especially Christians. They don't want to lay any blame on like the Jews and the Torah for the Zionist New World Order conspiracy. They want to say like, it's almost like Christians have a blind spot. So they want to say, oh, it's only the Talmudic Jews, or it's actually the secular Jews that are the problem. But I see the main source of the Jewish control coming from just straight from the Torah and the Talmud and Kabbalah that are predicated on the Torah.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't completely disagree with that. And again, I would invoke the Islamic doctrine that the Torah has not been well kept and well transmitted. And I think there are all sorts of very problematic things in the Torah. And as I said, I think the interpretation of the Torah, the Jewish interpretation of the Torah that Guillenot deconstructs in From Yahweh to Zion, is problematic. And again, it does contribute to these problems. I'm totally with you on that. But I just think that today, when I look around the world, the problems that I see are really not that we're faced with this likelihood of a bunch of these crazy rabbis that you put in your video taking over the world and ruling us from Jerusalem and forcing us to follow the Noahide laws. I think it's much more likely that we're going to have Klaus Schwab and the other atheists from Davos putting together a techno dystopia, with people like Yuval Harari being the high priests of this new religion of the elite. So yeah, they're going to enslave the masses, but they're all atheists, and they're going to use technology developed by their ultra materialist atheism to enslave the masses. And these rabbis may be, you know, blabbing in the ghetto of Brooklyn, and they're not going to be players in this game.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned technology, because the Gaon of Vilna, the top Kabbalist rabbi of the 17th century, was all about technology being the means that they're going to be able to fulfill their prophecies.
No, Gaon of Vilna, that's not the same guy as Abarbanel. Different one.
No. Yeah. And you see, Israel is like, as Netanyahu says, quote, a rising power among the nations, among the Goyim. And through their advanced technology, through their, teaming up and leeching off of America via Christianity for the most part, and, you know, obviously money and political influence. But that is how they're going to be able to achieve it. And if they're able to engineer prophecy to be involved in two world wars that led to the creation of Israel, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that they can engineer Gog and Magog, Armageddon, World War III, and then come out on top with a technocracy that's largely controlled, you know, through Israel and their allies, and their new Belt and Road Initiative and their Abraham Accords. And after they destroy Edom, which is America and the Christian West, because Christianity and Islam weren't meant to last forever. They're meant to be ultimately destroyed and destroy each other.
Well, from the point of view of, you know, extremist Jewish millenarian messianic thought, that may be true. That thought is just one little speck on this massive, you know, ocean of thought, of different schools of thought, you know, sweeping around the world. And again, I don't really see the world wars being plotted by pious Jewish rabbis. I mean, I see the world wars being plotted by atheist bankers whose families lost faith like at least a century before. And I also see these various kinds of atheistic, millenarian, messianic belief systems, like Marxism, for example. The people who basically want to get beyond humanism and, you know, re-engineer humans, the transhumanists. These kinds of messianic, millenarian belief systems that have split off partly from Judaism, probably mostly from Judaism. You know, like Karl Marx, of course, was influenced by his Jewish roots, but they're also, you know, drawing on all kinds of millenarian thought. Those systems, I think, are pretty far apart, really, from traditional pious Jewish thought.
And not Kabbalah, though. Not Kabbalah.
Yeah, Kabbalah is a weird thing. I mean, isn't Kabbalah like largely about doing called a form of mysticism, but it often lends itself to magical practice or black magic. So people who want to manipulate the world and perhaps even history through these kinds of esoteric and magical means may be using the Kabbalistic system. But again, I don't think that means that they're necessarily sort of pious Orthodox Jews by any means. I mean, Aleister Crowley used the Kabbalah, right, for Satanism, and so have so many others, MacGregor Mathers, William Butler Yeats. And there's this massive esoteric tradition out there that draws on Kabbalah, but isn't exactly Jewish, is it?
Well, you know, talk about like leading transhumanists, like Zuckerberg. I got a clip of Zuckerberg saying that what inspires him is something his rabbi told him about how God creates. So Zuckerberg loves to create things. And like Facebook bought out WhatsApp, the big messaging app that was started by a Russian Jew, and he is one of the biggest financiers of Chabad-related groups. It, recently was big articles written about that. So of course there is many, many high-level atheists out there and secular people, but there is, you know, I'm not saying it's a monolithic complete control, but the religious influence, you know, throughout the world, you can't downplay the religious influence on things, put it that way.
Okay. And so finally, we only have a few minutes left. What do you
I've
think
enjoyed
about...
the talk very much, too. I knew this would be a good one.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's great. I missed talking with you. It's been a couple of years, and I was looking forward to it. So how about Trump? You know, I had Art Olivier on here. He's a student of Freemasonry, not a practitioner, just he's a hostile student of Freemasonry. And he thinks that Trump is the chosen one, like mm-hmm. the Jewish Messiah who will be the Antichrist for the Christians and the Muslims. And you have Trump talking about how Israel owned Congress and how wonderful that was, and how mm-hmm. Israel had such power and rightfully over Congress. So, and Trump is trying to make, you know, come back as a kind of a chosen one. Do you see him as playing a role in this?
I definitely do. You know, I'm suspicious if he's been groomed for a long time to play out some messianic role. In fact, I just did a live stream last night titled, "Is Trump the Jewish Messiah to Destroy America?" Because they believe in Isaiah 63, it talks about a Messiah will rise up out of Edom and will destroy Edom. And this is what the Messiah is meant to do. He comes. This is what the Kabbalah is full of, by the way. There's no actual magic in the Kabbalah. It's just a bunch of like Jewish manifesto ramblings, cryptically hiding their messianic blueprint plans, basically. And it involves only the Jews being around in the world to come in the messianic age, and Esau being completely destroyed. In order for their messianic age to commence, which must be their timetable is it's happening in the next 220 years, because we're in the year 5780 something on the Jewish calendar. And shoot, I forgot my train of thought when I got off
Trump would be a good like sort of, you know, Antichrist Messiah to destroy Edom. I mean, he's definitely an agent of extreme destabilization in the West.
Absolutely, yes. I also had on, there's a guy on Twitter that built up a big account really quick. He's got like 30,000 followers now, and he's the whole account is just about documenting that Trump is the Antichrist. I had him on to do a show that was really popular, got a lot of views, and I just did the video last night playing clips of rabbis calling Trump, many rabbis calling him the Messiah of Edom. And this is what all the rabbinical literature is about. Edom, Esau must be destroyed. Esau and Amalek have to be blotted out in order for their messianic age to commence. And that basically translates as the destruction of the Christian West in a big war using Islam against them.
Interesting. Well, I hope it doesn't pan out that way, but you never know.
Look at Russia, Iran, Turkey, America, Israel, and what will happen if there is a big war? Israel will most likely instigate it somehow with Iran, or you know, what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. And I think America will end up going down, and Israel may betray, and then they'll just set up their new Abrahamic Accords, Belt and Road Initiative with China, and, you know, the... Are we closing out?
Get the bumper music, Adam, yeah. So we're going to have to leave it off there, but I'll have to try and ask Sheikh Imran Hussain what he thinks of your scenario. It sounds pretty pretty interesting. Well, thank you so much. It's great talking again.
Thank you. No more news to find more of my material. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Okay. Thank you, Adam. Bye.
All right.
This is Kevin Meredith, TruthJihad.com. Back next week. See you then.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m.